some different noises I hadn't heard before. I don't know what happened there. Exodus chapter 22. Last half of 22 and the first 9 verses of 23. This morning we will, I'm pretty sure, finish up the case law. And I don't think there's any more instances of case law in the book of Exodus. Reading through it and with looking for that and don't remember seeing any. There are more in Deuteronomy for sure and other of the Pentateuch, but not in Exodus, I don't believe. And this morning, we're going to be transitioning out of those into the last half or so of our text. And I want you to, and I'll tell you that because I want you to kind of pay attention as we read the text and see if you can tell where we finish the case law, where it gets into what I'm calling the golden rule. Everybody knows what the golden rule is. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that's not exactly how we probably ought to look at the last half of our text this morning, but it's similar to that. And so we're making this transition. It's almost a seamless transition. It's hard to kind of, you're past it and out of the case law before you realize it. It's, or at least I was. It's a seamless transition from specific sanctions that God places on certain behavior and more to warnings about God's retribution. Remember, we had sanctions. There was a capital crimes for this, capital crime for that, 4 ox or 5 oxen for an oxen, 4 sheep for a sheep, double restitution for this, double restitution for that. Can't pay your debts, you're sold into slavery, servitude, till you can pay them off. So there were specific sanctions that were mentioned. But somewhere along the way in our text, you'll notice the sanctions are no longer mentioned. So kind of be looking for that. We could also look at it as a seamless transition from case law to a, if I've got this in quotes, proverb. Because it's not really like the Proverbs. It's a little more severe than Proverbs, a little more harsh than Proverbs, but yet similar. He tells them 2 times a statement in our text that I want you to note as well. That having been oppressed yourself is a reason to see to it that you don't oppress others, because you know how it feels. You're going to see that in our text as well. In fact, that's where the title of the sermon comes from, Knowing the Heart of a Stranger. We're going to be looking at 13 situations, and we're going to see them in 25 verses. So that's one situation for about every 2 verses. So we're going to be talking about several different things. Some of them may only take 15 seconds. Some of them may take 45 minutes or less. Better hope there's lots of 15-second ones in there, right? So let's read our text and keep those things in mind as we read it. Chapter 22, beginning in verse 16. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. You shall not permit a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. He who sacrifices to any god except to the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. You shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him. Now here's the first one. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any way and they cry at all to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. That's a little more severe than a proverb, isn't it? If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like the money lender to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's garment as a pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering. It is his garment for his skin. What will he sleep in? And it will be that when he cries to me, I will hear, for I am gracious. You shall not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Likewise you shall do with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the 8th day you shall give it to me. And you shall be holy men to me. You shall not eat meat torn by beast in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. In chapter 23, verse 1, you shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. You shall not pervert the judgment of the poor in his dispute. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. You shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. Also, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So there's our text. The difference between case law and a proverb. Now, remember I said these are not proverbs, but they're not case law either. Case law teaches us what is, at least outwardly, righteous. It's a righteous thing to do this, to do that. Now, obviously, we know we can do outwardly, we can do right things, and our heart be far from being righteous. The case law teaches us what is right. A proverb teaches us what is wise. See the difference there. Violating, look at this from a negative perspective, violating case law is just wrong. It's immoral. It is wrong. Violating a proverb is just stupid. It's just stupid. There are sanctions, legal sanctions, for violating case law. There's not for violating a proverb. I may see Don Tibbett on my way home with a flat tire down the road, and I may wave at him as I drive by. I may not stop and help him. Or see if he needs help. That's not illegal. It's not very wise, though. It's not very good of me to behave in such a manner. So that's kind of where we're at. In our text, we've made a transition from some things that were sanctions were given for, and we end it with a lot of strong admonitions to behave and this way, to do this and do that, but they're not necessarily illegal. I mean, they can become that way, obviously, but not necessarily illegal to do so. So let's look at them. 13 instances. I've got them grouped together in similar things into, I think it's five or six. Six different instances. So we're kind of grouping some of these together. The first one is responsibilities of fathers. We see this in two verses, verses 16 and 17. Let's read the verses again. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. And these two verses, we first need to define a few terms. Make sure everyone knows what we're talking about. The first word that I want to define is entice. It says if a man entices a virgin. What does it mean to entice someone? It means to seduce. It means to persuade. It means that in this persuasion, there is an element of not revealing the end result of what this would be like. It may be that when you find yourself at the end of this, you would wish that you'd chosen a different path. But enticing is to persuade someone to do something that perhaps they ordinarily would not do. Now, obviously, our text here is talking about the relationship between a young man and a young woman, or a man and a woman. Actually, the text says a man and a virgin who's not betrothed. Now, you know as well as I know, this is the way it's been for since this was written and before. When a young man and a young woman begin to date or begin to be romantically attracted to one another, the enticement goes which direction? From the man toward the woman. It is the man who is doing the enticing, the woman who is being enticed. What percentage of the time do you think that's the case? 99?
No.
Okay? It's not always that way, we know. When the woman is doing the enticing, the Bible has a name for her in Proverbs. A strange woman. But most of the time, it's the man who is enticing the female, the male who is enticing the female, the male who is spending and exerting a lot of effort trying to get the female to do what he wants her to do. That's the way it is. We all know that. So there's that word, entice. The second word we need to define is a virgin. We know what a virgin is. It's a woman who is sexually pure. The word betrothed, it's a word we don't use. It's very similar to our word engage, an engagement. Someone who is engaged is very similar to the word in this period of time if we would have said this woman is betrothed. Right? There is already a promise, an arrangement that the male and the female will be married at such a time. Okay? It is different in different aspects. At least this one, for sure, when a woman is betrothed in this day, it is almost as if she were married. Okay, there are certain things that, certain penalties, certain ways that they look at this, that if she betrays this betrothal, she is viewed as committing adultery, even though she is not yet married. Okay, so there's this word, betrothed. Think of engagement, but a little more than that. The phrase, lies with her. Now, in case we know what that means, but in case you have doubts about it or wonder specifically, it's just talking about having sex. Talking about sexual intercourse. Or anything remotely close to that. Okay? The two words, bride price, is in our text. I also put down here a different word, dowry. We're going to define those a little bit as we get a little further in this text here. If you want to read Deuteronomy chapter 22 sometime, I think it's about the last half of that chapter, it will give you in detail more scenarios than ours right here. Ours is a specific scenario, and let's see what it says. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed, okay, not betrothed, and lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. Okay, let's stop there for a second. Deuteronomy 22, we'll give you three other situations and so that we can distinguish between these. Deuteronomy 22, you will have an example of consensual sex between a man and a betrothed woman. And we're talking, the man here is not her, the person she's betrothed to in Deuteronomy. It's a different person. She's betrothed to John, and she's lying with Frank. Okay? It's consensual sex between a woman and a man who is, she is not betrothed to, but she is betrothed. The penalty in Deuteronomy 22, the penalty for such an event, they are both killed. Because that is a case of adultery. And they're both stoned. Non-consensual sex between a man and a woman who is betrothed to someone else is also a capital crime. But only for the man. Because that is the crime there is rape. So the man is guilty of a capital crime, that being rape. Non-consensual sex between a man and a non-betrothed woman. So here's a woman who is not engaged, and some man sleeps with her. What is the crime there? Again, it is rape. Non-consensual. So the man is killed, and the woman, of course, is not. The fourth one is the issue that we're looking at today. It is consensual sex between a man and a non-betrothed woman. So that's where, that is our text. If a man lies with a virgin who is not betrothed, they're not engaged, and he lies with her, what does it say? He shall surely pay the bride price according for her to be his wife. Now, let's look at this. The first thing is this. This text says nothing about pregnancy. The issue is not whether she is pregnant or not. The issue was unlawful and immoral relationships. What happens in this instance? What does our text say happens? Will they marry or will they not marry? Okay, we've all heard the phrase shotgun weddings, right? That phrase refers to a father who is a shotgun forcing this man to marry his daughter. That's kind of where that comes from. So what happens? Who decides if they marry? In our text, the father. The father decides. It's not the young girl. It's not her mama. It's not a judge. It's not a jury. It's not the preacher. It's not the priest. And it certainly is not the young man. It's the father. When we have a marriage ceremony, traditionally, here's what you hear. Father brings his daughter down the aisle, and they get to the front, and the preacher says, who gives this bride away, who gives this young girl away? And what's the answer? Her mother and I is what we usually hear nowadays. Right? I can remember the first time I heard that particular phrase. That particular phrase, her mother and I, is a very recent addition to that tradition. I remember times when the answer was her father. Or the father said, I do. I tell you, I think we have lost something. This is not a kicking the mother under the bus necessarily, but I think we've lost something by adding her to that statement. It's certainly she is giving her daughter away, yes. But it's something there when the father stands alone with his daughter and says, I do. Our culture has come a long ways from this. A young woman is to be under the protection of her father from her birth until she is given away. We say those words and we have long ago lost their meaning. Given away. This young girl is under the protection of her father until that protection and that provision is transferred from her father to her husband. Now, perhaps you are a little too liberated to buy into that. Frankly, I don't care. I wanted to say I don't give a. I'm sorry. But that's the way it is. It is not anyone's decision to make except, dear old dad. There's a lot that comes into dad's making that decision, I know. I know dad will talk to his wife. I know he'll talk to his daughter. I know all these things. I know he's going to risk his daughter running away. I know all these things. I understand. But still, the responsibility is on his shoulders and on his alone. So what's this deal with a bride price? Our text says the young man is to pay a bride price of virgins to father or the father and the family. And if the father, in order for him to be his wife, it would be the same thing he would pay as if he's going to marry her. If the father refuses to let her marry him, he's going to pay it anyway. Right? That's what it says. Verse 17, if the father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay the money according to the bride price of virgin. He pays it anyway. So what is these things? I have heard of this word dowry, not so much bride price, but dowry all of my life. And, you know, some confusion in my mind as to what it actually means. And I did lots of reading, lots of digging, and there is lots of folks just as confused as I am. All right, you'll find an equal number of people that says a dowry goes from a bride to the groom's family, as you will say, it's going from the groom to the bride's family. Now, there you go. That's a big swing right there. We still don't know what it means. All right, but that's how much disagreement of opinion it is about the definition here. I've come to what seems right to me, and it may, if you don't think this is right, then that's okay. I certainly could be wrong. But look what I've got here. A dowry goes from a bride's family to the groom's family to help ensure her provision. A bride price goes from the groom's family to the bride's family. The idea, at least one idea, is to demonstrate his ability to care for their daughter. Okay, both of these things, to a lesser degree, I think a much lesser degree, display or a display of generosity between the two families who are fixing to be bonded together to some extent by the marriage of their children. Both of these things are important because in most cultures at this time, and in our day it's not so much this way, but very few women were part of the economy. Their work was seldom income generating. And thus, they were more dependent upon their father or their husband for their sustenance. But there is still this concern that if the husband dies, what's going to happen to the wife? Or if the husband is a bum and won't provide for his wife, or if he runs off and leaves her, you know, what's going to happen? That concern is attempted to be dealt with to some extent before they were married. In this instance, in our text today, the bride price is going from the man, from the groom, to the woman, whether they marry or not. That's our first one. Let's hope the rest are quicker, right? Number two, laws regarding worship and spiritual activity. You see, I've got 5 of these instances are lumped into this one. The practice of witchcraft is a capital offense. Now, what you're going to see here in these 5 things is that there is a blending or a crossover between civil government and religious government. There is a mix between civil law and spiritual activity. The practice of witchcraft is a capital offense. The practice of idolatry is a capital offense. In verse 20, he who sacrifices to any god except to the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. I take that to mean he's killed. Verse 18, you should not permit a sorcerer to live. Verse 28, do not revile God nor curse a ruler of your people. Number 29, verse 29 and 30, you shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Let me back up. It's interesting that the Hebrew word there for juices is tears. And I think the idea is there of any of your harvest that would bring forth juices. Like you squeeze a grape, juice drips out of it. Other things as well. But in 29 and 30, he emphasizes giving the first fruits of your increase. All right, this is very similar to a proverb. Honor the Lord with your substance, the first fruits of all your increase. The proverb gives a promise, so shall your barns be filled with plenty and your press shall burst out with new wine. And then the last one, laws were given that reminded them they were a holy people. Verse 31 there, you shall be holy men to me. And as such, you are not to eat meat that has been torn by a beast in the field. This makes it, in a way, doubly unclean, because the beast that has torn it was almost always an unclean animal itself, and then the animal that was killed was not bled properly, as he would give them instructions, so that animal is unclean. God is concerned that we do these things this way, he says, because you are a holy people to me. Present yourself as a holy person to God. So that's number two. Now, there's an idea here that I want to just, surely I'm not the only person who's ever thought of this. But years ago, and every once in a while since then, you hear someone say, well, since they took prayer out of schools, here's what's happened. And we're talking about this mix between religion and the government. And I remember when I was in fifth grade, that was the grade that the Gideons came every year and passed out little New Testaments to everybody in school. I got one. So did everybody else in my class. I'll never forget that, because there was a Mexican boy there, and we had never seen Mexicans before. And he was new that year in school, and he didn't know, of all things, never heard of John 3:16. Wasn't long before the kids in the fifth grade class helped him memorize John 3:16. Now, this was a public school. The teacher, I called her Aunt Marie. She wasn't my aunt. She was my cousin's aunt. But things were a little different, weren't they? They were. And sometimes we lament, there's no prayer in school, there's no Bible reading in school, and all these things. I remember years ago, my dad told me, he said, I don't think there ought to be. It kind of got my attention. You know, I didn't sound like the party line. And I said, well, why not? He said, who's going to pray? And I didn't have to stop, think very long about that to come up with a big list of names of teachers that I didn't want praying. Right? They may have been atheists, they may have been Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, who knows what they were, but I wasn't. They may have been Methodists, of all things, you know. You don't want them praying. You get my point, right? Who's going to, if we're going to have this mix of the church and the state, who's going to mix it? And who's going to say what's right? I don't have the answers for that. Deb will. Yeah, as long as I get to mix it, it's okay, right? I don't have the answers for that. It's hard for me to be satisfied with a society, with a secular government that does not acknowledge God at all. But somehow I think that it is not our job as the church to govern. It is our job as a church to influence those who do. It is our job to be salt and light to the earth, to be the conscience of the state. How that works its way out, I'm not sure. But the situation, regretfully say, is not to be like this. I really don't think that's our place as a society, to put to death those whose religion is different than ours. As bad as I want to. Let's go on. Number three. Laws forbidding bestiality. Verse 19, whoever lies with an animal shall be surely put to death. This was a capital crime. I want to make one statement. We all know what this refers to, but I'll make one statement. Don't ever forget this, especially the younger people here. Sexual perversion. is never satisfied. Never satisfied. What will satisfy you today will not satisfy you tomorrow. And it's always moving in a perverted direction. Number four, warnings about taking advantage of the poor and weak. These are verses, there are one, two, three, four instances here that I've got lumped into this one. And let's look at them. The first instance is take care not to take advantage of a person when you know they are in a tight spot. Verse 21, you shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. What does that look like to us? If I'm driving on vacation, now in fact, this happened in a way to me and Susan a few years ago. We went to the Ark Encounter. On our way there, our car just started carrying on, acting up. And I am not a mechanic. If the thing cranks, I'm ready to roll. I don't care if it's missing or not. If it cranks up, let's go. But if it wasn't going, I had to pull over, and I got off and got to a little service station. So here we are in Kentucky. I don't remember the town. I didn't know anybody. I could have been taken advantage of. I needed someone to jump me off. I could have been taken advantage of. But there are usually people around who will do the nice thing. I didn't even have jumper cables. There was someone there in a work truck, and he was a good candidate for having jumper cables, so I asked him, and yes, he did. He knew someone else, or actually he didn't, but he knew someone else at the gas pumps who did. And they got us jumped off, got us on our way. I was a stranger in a strange place, and someone could have taken advantage of me. I would have been willing to pay $40 for somebody to jump me off, $60. I just need to be able to go. Second thing, warning not to mistreat widows and orphans. Notice what he says in 22 through 24. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any way, and they cry at all to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with the sword. This sounds serious, doesn't it? Your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. God is serious about widows and orphans being mistreated. This isn't the only place in the Bible where this type of harsh language is used about this subject. This is a common refrain throughout the Scriptures, Old Testament and New, about what God says about mistreating widows and orphans. Third one, the issue here, and this is in verse 25 to 27. If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you should not be like a moneylender to him. You should not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's garment as a pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering. It is his garment for his skin. What will he sleep in? Notice the next line. And it will be when he cries to me. Who's doing the crying? The person that you have taken a pledge from them. They have nowhere to sleep that night because you have taken it from them. They will cry to God. And God says, I will hear. And that you can read in between the lines from the previous thing. God says, I will hear because I am gracious. Now what's going on here? Taking advantage of someone who is poor, taking advantage of someone who's in a bad spot financially, says don't charge them interest. This is not a blanket statement against usury. It's not a blanket statement against interest, charging interest. It's not a blanket statement against banks loaning money. What it is a blanket statement against you having the ability to loan money. You're wealthy, you've got money, you could lend money out. And Mike Harmon here wants to borrow some money. And you believe he's got the ability to repay you. So you'll loan him money. I need a loan. You don't have the slightest bit of confidence that I can ever pay you back. I'm a bad credit risk. So you won't help me, but you will help him. Now that might be good business sense, but it is poor charity. It is poor character. Now, I'm not saying that banks ought to give out money interest free. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying when you, as an individual, have the ability to help someone, and your decision to help them or not is based on their ability to repay you, be careful. Be careful. In our public court system, there is someone who is called a public defender. A public defender is, I may have not have this exactly right, but it's a lawyer who defends someone who cannot hire their own lawyer. That's the way I understand it. Is that correct? Okay, here's the deal. At least my understanding. It may not be this way in Arkansas, but it's this way in some states, and I'm pretty sure it's this way in Arkansas. Every lawyer, this is the way it was explained to me, every lawyer has a responsibility to a certain percent of the time, or maybe they're on a rotating basis, but to serve as a public defender for a poor person for no charge, carrying out the principle that we see right here. Poor person is brought to court, they don't have the ability to hire a lawyer, so lawyers rotate and they hate it, right? Because they're doing this work for nothing. And guess what? The judge can tell if they're just going through the motions. And you can get in serious trouble if you do not do a good job on this free work you're doing. That's what this is about. Don't take advantage of the poor. Notice he says in verse 7, the first part, keep yourself far. Now we could legitimately fill in that phrase with a lot of things. Keep yourself far from a host of things that you and I ought to keep ourselves far from. Most of them, we don't want to. We want to be right in the middle of it. We want to get as close as we can and still consider ourselves righteous. The end of verse 7, he says, God will not justify the wicked. Ever. Only through Christ, we obviously know. But he will never look at a wicked and an unjust situation and on its own merit say, this is right. Verse 8, he talks about bribes. You shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning. A bribe blinds your discerning spirit. You discern something is right or wrong, and you know it's right, or you know it's wrong, but for $100, well, maybe it's not so wrong after all. Clouds your judgment. Be careful. not to take advantage of the poor and weak. Number five, warnings about the crowd you run with. Notice we've gone from laws. I'm calling these not laws, but warnings. Warnings about the crowd you run with. Chapter 23, 1 through 3. You should not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. So this verse is talking about things you say, things that you report, things that you go along with. You put your hand with this evil group, a wicked group of people, and report something that is not accurate. Be cautious. See on the outline about repeating untrue events that slander another person's character. You don't have to repeat everything you hear. I know it's no fun, but you don't have to. Especially, don't do it intentionally with the intent to harm someone's character. Don't associate yourself, verse 2, closely and regularly with those who practice wrongdoing. You will likely end up facing the same judgment. Notice what he says in verse 2, you should not follow a crowd. There you go again, hanging with people you hang around with. Do not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. You're going the same way as the crowd. And sooner or later, you will be faced the same judgment that they face whether you did it or not. Look at verse 3. This is between verse 3 and verse 6. They seem to be saying opposite things. But look at verse 3. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. When we show partiality to someone, they are better off for our partiality, for our partial treatment, aren't they? We tend to look at the good as going that direction. We don't tend to look at, I'm showing partiality to Don and he ends up in the ditch because of my partiality. No, when we say I show partiality to him, I'm doing something that favors him. It says, do not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. There is something more righteous than helping a poor man in a bad situation. And that thing is righteousness. Let's not lie about Don's poor state to get him some help. Let's be honest first. The first thing is let's make sure the situation is laid out properly and rightly. Let's not give Don help by being dishonest, by making up some lie, some tale to get him some help. That is not the way you do it. You do things that are right, and then if he needs help, we help him. But you don't show partiality so that the end result will be he gets something. You don't show partiality and say things that are not true to disguise and to hide things, so that Don gets help in his poverty. That is not the way to do it. Notice I've got here, being poor is not an excuse for injustice, and neither is socialism. Because someone is poor doesn't mean socialism is right. Number six, back to the golden rule. This is verses 4 and 5. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him again. If you You see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it. Now that phrase, and you would refrain from helping it, is a picture that as you standing there, you're driving by and you see this situation with your neighbor's ox. And you would refrain from helping him. That phrase is that period of time where you're deciding, am I going to stop or am I going to go on? And in that period of time when you're trying to decide what you're going to do, he tells you what to do. You will surely help him. We've lived where we live now, or within 300 yards of where we live now, or since January of 1984. We have really settled down. We lived there for 36 years. Out in the country, lots of barbed wire fences, lots of pastures, and lots of fences that were new 50 years ago. Lots of barbed wire that's old and rusty and broken. In the course of those 36 years, I can think of two neighbors that we had and may still have. To stop and think, but their cows habitually get out. And we first moved there, this verse and this principle was fresh on my mind. And I would stop. We didn't have cell phones. I'd stop, try to find where the cow got out, try to get it back in, hopefully somebody else would come along and help or whatever. There's a neighbor or two that would not fix their fence. This one day I was driving down the road and the fence was laid over. The old cedar post still attached to the rusty barbed wire. I got out, got the cow, I think just went back in on its own. I got the wire, the post, stood it up, and it's just... The post is not holding the wire up. The wire is holding the post up. And I remember feeling so frustrated because I've taken 15 whole minutes of my time. I know it. 15 minutes of my time trying to fix my neighbor's fence. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I told myself, his cows can get out, I don't care. If he's not going to fix his fence, then somebody butcher his cows. Take it home with you. Perhaps that's not right. I don't know. We used to go on our way to town, there's a man that had a to one of the junkiest yards, even worse than my place. On the right, you can see it from the highway, just stuff everywhere. He used to have a horse that was in a one-strand electric fence about this high. That's all that was keeping this horse in, was one electric wire about this high, and it would be like having him fenced in a little area right here in front of this highway. With the first strand almost in the ditch, just back this way from the ditch a little bit. And that horse would, the area he had fenced in was just about the size of this room, except it was longer and slimmer. And that horse would run from one end of that thing to the other, and I knew any time now he's going to jump the little electric wire and get out in the road and get somebody hurt. You know, he never did. I expected it every day when I drove by there. And, you know, he's in the fence, but it ought not to be that way. Somebody, somewhere down the road is going to have to help that man take care of his horse because he will not do it right. And I'm about out of the mood. I ain't saying that's right. I ain't. But this is more than that. This says if your not neighbor's ox, if your enemy's ox, somebody you don't like, you shall surely bring it back to him. We've had cows come down our driveway to our house. And if you see a cow coming down our driveway, you know he's going the wrong place. He's headed the wrong direction. All right? To help them get them back. Even if I don't like the guy, even if the guy hates me, even if the guy would cheat me if he had the opportunity. Seems to be what it says. Now let's go on. Let's quit talking about that one, all right? How often do I have to do that? You see what I've got there? Till seven times? That reminds you of Peter in the New Testament? I don't have an answer for that. I think we should err on the side of it costing us, though. But I think somehow, some way, sloppy neighbors need to be held accountable for their stuff. But it needs to cost me first. Knowing the heart of a stranger. We're going to close with these two phrases. He says, remember these things. Treat these people this way because you remember what it was like in Egypt. Do you know what it's like to hurt? Do you know what it's like to be lonely? Be in debt. You know what it's like to have your car repossessed. To be out of work. To live with constant pain day after day, year after year. Do you know what it's like to be an orphan? Do you know what it's like to live in your own home with fear? All of us could tell stories. I could name you a man in our area that every one of you would know his name. He told me he remembered his little boy. 4 or 5 years old, hiding under the kitchen table while his drunk father chased his mother around the table to beat her. Living with fear. Do you know what it's like to feel unwanted? To think that God must not be listening to you. God must not hear. Do you know what it's like to feel unloved? Have you ever needed forgiveness? I mean, real, serious forgiveness. I'm not talking about forgiveness because somebody didn't speak to you. I'm talking about, have you ever needed to be forgiven of something really serious? Don't forget it. Don't forget how that felt. Now, perhaps you might say, well, we need to forget it. There is a sense in which I probably would agree with that, but there is a sense in which you don't need to forget it. You don't need to forget it because it is so easy for us to come to the place where we are eager and willing to step on someone who is hurting. Not remembering how it felt. Let's pray.